Hi, everybody. Welcome to Buzzing About Romance. I am Leah, and on this episode, I'm giving you a quick shot of romance author spotlight edition. And on this author spotlight, I'm welcoming author Bryn Donovan. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Bryn Donovan is the author of several romance novels, including Sunrise Cabin, a Publisher's Weekly bestseller. She's also written nonfiction books and the story treatments for two Hallmark Channel movies. Her work has appeared in McSweeney's, Writer's Digest, and many literary journals. A former executive in publishing, she earned her MFA in creative writing from the University of Arizona. She's a voracious reader, a rescue dog lover, and a hopeless romantic who lives in the Chicago area and blogs about writing and positivity. Well, those are very exciting things. So before we talk her Time Traveling Duke, which is your newest release, let's get to know you a little bit. So clearly you worked in like the publishing world, but what drew you to start writing?
Absolutely. So I was always interested in writing. And in college, I wrote poetry, and then I got my MFA in poetry.
Okay.
And so growing up and also in college and grad school, I never read romance at all.
Okay.
And I actually had ignorant prejudices against the genre. And part of it was that I thought everybody in romance had to be perfect looking. And
Okay.
I thought, you know, that's not me, you know, I'm not the homecoming queen here. And so I had really ignorant prejudices against it. And when you judge something without having read it, which many people who consider themselves literary are in this position, like that is actually the definition of ignorance, you know. And when I first read a few romance novels, I realized that there was something I loved about them that I was missing from literary fiction. And always in my graduate writing workshops, my professor, I did well with publishing poetry, but my professors would tell me, you're a romantic and romanticism is out of favor in the literary world, you know? And so I read romance novels and realized that there, you were allowed to be more hopeful without people criticizing you for it. And you were allowed to write these big, expansive emotions, you know, where in literary writing, that tends to be a little suspect to have those really big emotional scenes. And so then I realized that I really loved it, but I came to it quite late.
Well, and it's one of those things where it's like I started reading it very early, way earlier than I should have. Like I tell the story all the time. Like my mom got like the box Harlequins in the mail every month. So I started reading it like 12, 13. Like I just because
Oh,
they were
that's amazing.
all over my house. And like my and I mean, I grew up in a time where like my parents did not like police what I read. And if they did, like clearly I read it anyway. So, but it's one of those things where like I was exposed to it very early. And so like I never understood why people have such a hang up with it. And I mean, it's a $1 billion industry. Clearly they're doing something right.
Absolutely. The first time I read it, it was because I thought I should at least know what's going on here. And then it turned out it was something that I really loved.
So for you, what made you decide to publish that first book? The first
Well,
romance book.
it took me a while, like honestly, an embarrassingly long time coming from poetry to understand how to structure a novel. And this is why I love writing about writing now, because I really understand that struggle and how it can be hard to make that leap. And so finally, when I tried to plot a novel in advance, I actually wrote a novel that, you know, at least worked. And so the first one I published was called An Experienced Mistress, and it was a historical novel, and it was published with a digital first publisher, the Wild Rose Press. But before that, there was a really long time of me just trying to figure out how it worked as someone who came from a genre where you don't have to think about structuring a long piece. So that was the first one I did.
Well, I feel like in poetry, or at least any poetry I've read, the forced stuff in high school and then even stuff later, like there's rules, but there's not rules at the same time.
Absolutely, yes. And I like a little bit of structure in poetry, but you don't have to have it, you know. And it's really just about expression and voice, and you don't even have to be. You can be ambiguous and or have more than one meaning, and you know, so it was very different to come to it, I think.
Well, and I personally, I view poetry as like, I mean, it's an artwork, an art form, and it's kind of like when you're looking at photography or sculptures or paintings, like everybody has a different like experience as they read it or look at it. Like it emotes different like emotions in people, and it's like it's very abstract in the way that like it affects people.
Definitely. Yes. And you're usually you're not saying something straight out a lot of times. So it took me a while to learn, and that's why I really like to talk to writers now. I mean, I mentioned before we got on here that my full-time job now is freelance book editor, and it is very full-time. I edit 1 to 2 books a week. So that is a really brisk pace. And I love working with writers now and talking to them about the important things in a romance novel. You have to know exactly why these two are perfect for each other. Not just that they're nice to, like, it would be nice if they were together, but really perfect for each other in the way other people aren't. And you have to be clear what the obstacle is on both sides, what is keeping them from getting together, and talking through some of the basics with people I really enjoy doing because. It took me a little while to kind of understand those basics.
So you said that you tried plotting your first novel. So when you're writing, do you plot now or do you just kind of let the story flow and pants it?
I absolutely do plot, and the more I plot, the better I get at it. But it took for years, I said to people, oh, I'm not a plotter. My brain doesn't work that way, as if I had some kind of special brain, which, you know, I don't, other than ADHD, which, you know, I don't. And the truth was that plotting felt uncomfortable to me because I wasn't used to it yet. Everything feels uncomfortable for you when you're not used to it. When you're still learning and it's hard, it's not fun. But I finally sucked it up and plotted a novel. It was the first one that really worked. And then I found that the more I did it, the more it became something fun. Okay. So, like, when I was still a greeting card writer at Hallmark Cards, I wrote the story treatment for a movie for Hallmark Channel. And it was like a 10 to 12 pages. Here's all the characters. Here's the plot. Here's everything that happens. So, very detailed plotting. And because by that time, it had become fun for me to plot, you know. And so, I think every writer should at least try it. Like, you can't say it doesn't work for you if you haven't tried it. And also, when you become a successful writer, you're going to be selling things on proposal anyway. So you may as well learn
So
now.
when you're doing like the movie treatment, is it
Yeah.
similar to the way that you plot your books, or do you?
Very similar. And one thing that I have learned to be very clear about, well, while I worked at Hallmark Channel, I was often in the position of pitching a story to TV producers or movie producers, I should say. Because I was the only person who worked in the publishing arm while I was there. And so the only editorial process they had was for me to pitch to the producers to get a book approved to publish. And so one thing I learned right away was to focus on the character arcs. So you have a character, and they're not going to be the same person at the end of the story that we met on page one. They've learned, or they've grown, or they've changed in some way. And so when I pitch a story and when I write a plot, when I'm doing plotting for myself, I start with the character arcs. What is this person and what is this person going to learn or change or grow throughout the story to get their happy ever after?
I think that's great. And it's and th I mentioned this at the before we start recording, and I say this often. I love these author spotlights because every author they like some authors have very similar like focuses. Like Naima Simone, I interviewed her recently, and she talked about how
Love her.
she creates her characters first, and the story all comes from like where like the characters draw from. But other authors, like they completely like they just sit in front of the computer and let it ride. Like it's just it's so fun to see all the different styles. And I talked to a couple where they're Nevessa Allen was telling me about the Pomodoro method. It's kind of like short sprints. And I've talked to a couple authors and they use it, but they use it differently in the way they use it, which it's just but it's so fascinating because everybody like the end product is a novel. But the way to get there from A to B is so different for everybody.
Absolutely. And with my background in publishing now, I won't start on a book. I won't do any work on it at all, really, until I have a title and a log line that
Okay.
I think is snappy, you
Okay.
know, because a lie that I heard for years as a writer is ideas are dime a dozen. It's really how you treat it. And then I became an acquiring editor. And I realized that sometimes with a query letter from an agent or from an author, I would read a title and read a log line and think, oh my goodness, I hope the pages are good because this is good, you know. And then I realized how important that sharp concept is. And so I won't start something until I have a title and a log line that I love. And really, like I got my agent just through a Twitter pitch. So
Oh,
that was just
really?
a, yeah, that was just a title and a log line. So that is always where I start now, like a concept that I really like. And then from there, I go to the characters and figure out what their deal is.
It's so funny because I interviewed Jo Segura recently, and
Oh, she's so great.
but she did a Twitter like query type thing too. And I'm like, that's just so crazy. I'd never, like, I knew that they existed, but I mean, it wasn't like I wasn't in the realm at that point, but I was like, oh my, that's kind of
If it
crazy.
can hit, it really hits. And then you get, and then you see, and this happened to me. I was very lucky, but you see someone like just racking up the likes. They've got a bunch of DMs because they just had something really sharp. And she absolutely did too.
Oh yeah, I read her Lust Crusade book for the it was
Wonderful
so
concept.
good. So
You know,
for
because it's familiar, the adventure with the romance, like it's familiar, but at the same time, we hadn't read a bunch of them. And
Yeah,
so it's
exactly.
just
It was
really
still it was
great.
such a fresh idea with like common like concepts that like we like. So can you share any rituals or habits that help you stay focused while you're writing?
Let me think about that. You mentioned the Pomodoro method, and I do like to do writing sprints too. And like a lot of authors, I do have ADHD. And so having the focus and saying I'm going to, which I haven't even been, I haven't even, I've always been shy to say that, but I've realized recently it's fine since so many people struggle with it anyway. And especially writers. So having that focus of writing for 25 minutes or so at a time is really helpful. And I think I'm going to do this again in January. I've even hosted months where on the weekdays, we sit down early in the morning on Zoom, anyone who wants to join me, and we'll do a 25-minute sprint and then chat a little, do another one. And for some reason, even though it's just people on the screen, even though I could just be writing a grocery list, they wouldn't know, you know. It's still, it creates like sort of a classroom atmosphere and keeps me focused. And so I really like writing with other people virtually or in person that way also. And a few of my, I'll sometimes get together a few other writers I know in the area, go to the library and we'll sit like chat for like an hour and then write for an hour.
Well, and everybody talks about how being an author is such a solitary like profession, which it is, and it but it's when you find those people that really like resonate and like you can like drop your ideas and bounce ideas back and forth, but and like with the creation of Skype and Zoom and all of those things, like it's made it easier for that connection.
Definitely. It is solitary, and I am a real extrovert as a writer, which is so unusual, I think. And so I'm always trying to force people to write with me.
Hey, I mean, whatever works. So, is there a piece of advice that present author you would give past author you?
I was talking about making sure that you had a really strong concept in, before you started writing, and that is something I wish I had understood much sooner. And people will talk about should I follow trends, should I not follow trends? More important than that, I think, is just to have that really snappy concept that's you can explain quickly that gets people's attention. Like, oh, I want to see how that plays out. You know, and so I think you have to be very, so people who are trying to get to the next level, a lot of times will say, well, I'm just going to write more, you know, just, and something will hit. And that's, and there is some truth to that, but I think more than that, it's about being really picky about the story that you decide to devote time to. Is it easy to pitch to someone else? And then also, does it have some personal meaning for you that you're going to be able to tap into again and again so you don't get tired of it on page 100? I can't even tell you how many books I got tired of, like around page 100 when I was still trying to figure out how to write a book. But if you have a theme in it or something about it that is personally meaningful for you, then it'll keep you motivated to write it. So like that external, easy to pitch, and that internal, have that personal connection to it.
Well, and as a reader, like you can definitely tell like when an author kind of like has phoned it in and like they've lost interest in the book, 'cause it just kind of it either falls off or it just kind of is like meh.
I have done a couple of ghostwriting projects, and I really appreciated the opportunity. And sometimes it was tough because it would be, I'll say, a subgenre that I didn't write, a tone that was very different from my tone. Like, oh, I would, you'd be shocked if I told you, okay. And if you've read, like, if you read my rom-coms, okay. But even with those, and I got really positive feedback, I'm happy to say, with those jobs. But with those, it was a struggle. And I felt I had to find the place where I connected to the story, even if it wasn't in broad strokes my story. You know, I had to find the way I could bring myself into it.
Right. So let's chat Her Time Traveling Duke. So this book comes out December 12th, 2026. It is a rom-com, Grumpy Sunshine. There is some time travel involved, hence the title.
Yes, it
So,
comes out, I think, December
oh,
9th.
December 9th. Yes. I do have it written down also, but I totally like read it wrong.
So yeah, coming right up. It doesn't matter. It's coming right up.
But so this book, it definitely has Kate and Leopold vibes. And yes, I'm aging myself when I say that because that movie came out in 2001, which I actually happened to look it up the other day out of curiosity because I wanted to double check something because it's been a while since I've seen it. And I was like, I can't believe it came out in 2001.
I did see it when it came out. And I wasn't thinking about it when I worked on this. And then, of course, a little ways into it, I remembered it, you know. So I always knew when, so Rose is a character from Her Night at the Museum. And so it is a sequel, although I don't think it's super important which
So
order
I did
you
not
did it.
read Her
I don't
Night at
think
the
it
Museum,
matters.
and I was not lost. Like I did not need to like when going into it, like the way that the characters from that book were introduced, like you can definitely read this as a standalone.
Yeah, I don't think there's huge spoilers. You know from the cover of Her Night at the Museum that he doesn't remain a stone statue for very long, for instance. I don't write that kind of romance. But Rose is a character, as soon as she walked on the page as a side character in Her Night at the Museum, I knew everything about her, which was unusual. Usually I have to work at character development. I knew everything about her. And so I always knew that she was going to be, as soon as I met her, like the heroine of the next book. And so it really started with her, I think.
Well, and so she has some witchy vibes, but
Yes.
in the best way. And so she works at the museum. She does social media for them, but I mean she is all over the place in other like aspects, but not
Yes.
she's not a chaotic person. She just is a lot. She's full of life. She like really takes care of everybody around her, which is like a hot button issue with her brother later on in the book.
Yes, and in book one, I actually got the editorial question, and it was a good question because Rose was a minor character. There were allusions to this heavy situation with her brother, and Rose has family tragedy in her past. They lost both their parents pretty young. I mean, when they were adults, but barely adults. And her brother got into trouble, got into drugs, even did a short served a short jail sentence. And so I got the question, understandably, because this is a rom-com and she's a side character. Do you want this heavy stuff in here, really? And I said, yeah, I do, because it's really important to who she is. And so you find out more in this book that she was really in this position of trying to be a caretaker, very difficult, in the absence of her parents. And so Rose has been through a lot. Like me, she grew up blue collar, but she has this a lot of sadness in her backstory. And I really enjoyed writing her because she is a goofball. She is a quirky, kind of silly person, and I think some and she does really try to be positive. She
She
does
does.
try to find the joy in little things. And I think that sometimes, I think I'm talking very personally here, actually, but I think sometimes when people encounter someone who's positive, who's smiley, they think this person has never had any troubles. And a lot of times it's the opposite. Yeah. And so because of that, I think I really liked writing her character.
Well, and there was just something about her character. Like she was so self-aware, which we don't always get. And like with her character arc, like there was growth, but there wasn't a lot of growth because she didn't really need that growth. Like she was very like, I am Rose, this is who I am, this is what I do. And like her main source of growth was the fact that like she realized like I do need to do things for myself. But
Yes,
it
that is her. That is definitely her character arc in this story, to realize that that her needs are important too. And she takes the first step when she does the little love spell
Yeah.
at the beginning. Someone asks her near the beginning, "Do you ever do try spells for anyone else?" And she for yourself, because she's always doing them for someone else. And she says, "Oh yeah," but she can't even remember the last time she did. She actually, this isn't in the book, but my headcanon is she started getting into doing these little spells when her brother was in trouble, when she was desperate to figure out some way to help and couldn't help. Let's try some magic. I don't know what
I
else to
mean, it's
do.
a I'm gonna try anything I can to make this better.
That's my headcanon for her. But yeah, her journey is to realize after being in this caretaking position, and in the first book, you see her helping out her friends, to realize that her needs are matter too. And at a certain point, without spoiling too much, she really stands up for herself as someone who's worth other people, someone else doing something for her.
Well, and so and we have Henry. He is the Duke from 1818, who she accidentally, or maybe not so accidentally, brings to the future. And Henry is a guy who is he is stuck. And he is just well, I mean, stuck. And there's really not much more to say. Like he's a grumpy, stuck Duke.
I love it that you call him stuck, because that's exactly my thought for him, that he's someone who's really stuck in the role that he plays, in his grief after losing his late wife, and stuck in his routines and really has of his world has become kind of small. And so of course I love a character like that to become unstuck in the most dramatic way possible by being ripped away to another time and another place entirely. So
Well, and part of his stuckness is this obsession with like the idea of time travel and the idea of going back and like going
yes.
back to what he lost. And when he moves forward, he's so out of place, and he's never had a position where he's felt dumb. Like
Yes.
he's always been one of the smarter ones in the room. And then when he gets to like present time and like he meets Rose and is learning things, and he feels very foolish a lot of times, even in like just the verbiage that he uses.
Yes, and it's maddening to him. So Henry did not completely fit in, even in his own time. He's socially awkward. There's a little bit of myself in all my characters. And one thing about me, besides having been a very, very awkward kid, someone who really struggled, I'm sure it's so hard to believe now because he's so graceful. No, but someone who really had trouble connecting with other kids and making conversation, and this is my idea with Henry. And also, I can get extremely obsessed with subjects sometimes for no, at least Henry
It's
has a
that
reason.
ADHD hyper focus.
Is it? Is that a thing?
Yeah, it is. Because my oldest has it, and he either has zero focus or he hyper focuses. Like there is no middle ground. And
Okay,
it's almost obsessive focusing.
I have to read about this because I was suddenly, and it's just something I was curious about. I don't even
But
have a
you will
good
go down a
reason.
rabbit hole for hours and not be able to come out.
Yes, I am unable to come out. Like one weekend, this is so embarrassing. One weekend several years ago, I spent the whole weekend learning about bluegrass music, which I have never listened to in my life. Like I got a little curious. I was like, what is it
You got this
exactly? How is it
little
different?
like plot bunny.
And all of a sudden, that was Monday morning. I was like, what did I do?
That is your ADHD.
It's like an intellectual bender. And so to me, so yeah, there's a little bit of me in every character. And so with Henry, his awkwardness, even when he was, when he was growing up, he is socially awkward. And then his obsession with things, just getting lost in it. Are things that I really relate to. And part of that, when I'm talking about finding your own way into a story, finding that connection with each character, I think part of it. Anyway, so, but he has always, his parent, I mean, they loved him, but his family, his father was a little embarrassed of him for being so awkward. And Henry's consolation, besides his great wealth, he thought that he had two things going for him. He's super rich and wealthy, which he thinks, of course, everybody likes. Rose, maybe,
Not
has her
so
criticism.
much. Not so much.
So he's super rich, and as you say, always the smartest guy in the room. And that's where he found his sense of worth. And so for him to be in this new situation where he's pretty much never the smartest guy. Is really
Like even the other guy who has traveled time has like more knowledge about things, but it's
yes, and he's like a brute from
yes.
the
Yeah, because when they first meet, like the scene where they meet and Griffin is talking about things and he's like, how does this guy know anything more than I do? Like he's so mad about it. And
yes.
he's somewhat rude, but I
Oh,
mean, I will say Rose calls him out on it.
he's so rude. Yes. And that scene is where he really feels mad for being stupid and really feels embarrassed in front of Rose, who he is, can't help but really be attached to. So Henry has to learn that he has value besides just knowing everything,
Well,
yeah.
and I think that having so grief is Grief is funny. It is very different for everybody, but it is one of those things where some people can get stuck in that grief and like not like they never go through the seven stages or the five stages. I can't remember how many stages there are, but there are some people who like they get stuck in a certain stage and like and they can't move past that. And Henry is a perfect example of that because his whole like personality has revolved around like almost the anger of it.
Absolutely. And I think that even though Henry has trouble connecting with other people sometimes, when he does love someone, he loves them so deeply, so much. And there are parts near the end of the book where so you always have declarations of love in a romance, and I really liked it because he feels things so deeply.
He does.
But he's really stuck. He's obsessed with the idea of going back and just reliving some time with his wife. He was only married to her for 2 years. And so when he finds out, when Rose tells him, "You've been pulled forward, sorry, didn't mean to, you've been pulled forward in time," she's surprised that his first reaction isn't time travel, but rather forward.
Well, and but as the story plays out, like we find that there's this kind of secret society that this Jason character is a part of, who he's on a little bit of an enigma, and I'm hoping we get more of him. But so they but the two of them go on like these capers and like try like steal things that belong to him back in 1818, and it's just this fun, like chaotic world of joy.
There's a little more about Jason, the curator, and his secret society in this book, just a little bit more. But the idea is that he is part of this group that is recovering magical art and artifacts further. And who is this group and why are they doing this? Those are still mystery. Those are still mysteries in this book.
Well, and her brother like is such a smart guy, and like she goes to him for like advice and help, and he kind of gets pulled into Jason's world a little bit more in by in this book, and by the end of the book, like we find out kind of why, but I'm not going to tell you that. You got to read it to figure that one out. But it just and it's kind of like he and her brother too, like it's kind of a circle moment for him because he's really starting to find his footing again. Like he definitely has been struggling because I mean he didn't get to finish college because of his addiction and then going to jail, and his journey is I mean his journey's really just beginning.
That's right. Her brother is a brilliant guy. He had a full ride scholarship at Northwestern, in the science in physics, and then his life just completely imploded.
And
And
grief is a
trying
fickle
to find
thing.
any kind of job after all this experience is so difficult, you know. And he and Rose are really close because they're the only family they've got left. That relationship is so important to her.
Well, and each relationship throughout the story, we have Emily and Rose and Jason, and then we have Rose and Aaron, who we had met in the previous book, but he's back. And it's just there's such touchstones and cornerstones in each relationship and how they play out and the importance of them in the book and how Henry adds and subtracts to each of those relationships as well. I just think it's such a great cast of characters and the way that you created the relationships and the connections, and there's disagreement, but they always come out good on the end.
They're very different personalities, and I do have a lot of fun with them. See how they react against each other.
Well, I and there's enough depth in the story and emotion, but you still have like those comic moments that lighten it in such a good way. I really enjoyed the caper aspect and the.
Oh, that was the caper was that is so much fun to write.
Yeah.
I love shenanigans. I love disguises and sneaking around. And so all of that was a lot of fun for me. Yeah.
Well, it was fun to read. So, what is next for you?
Right now, I am working on another rom-com novel, which I'm not going to say too much about it, but
Okay.
it does draw on my experience working in the entertainment industry and in LA. So
Okay.
I'll say that much. Yeah.
Okay. Well, we
Yeah.
look forward to that. Well, thank you so much, Bryn, for joining me on this author spotlight. It has been.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. It's so much fun.
And until next time, happy reading, everybody.
Find us on Instagram at Buzzing About Romance or on Twitter at Buzzing Romance. If you like the podcast, please leave a review. If you'd like to support us directly, join the Bookcase and Coffee Patreon and receive exclusive content only available to Patreon members. Check out bookcaseandcoffee.com for our on-the-shelf show notes.